I'll see if I can today. I'll maybe tell him to come by and sit in on Barry's time. And then I'll tell him about the New York.
Yeah, and if
you
send me an email, then I'll send you like her contact information and stuff. So it's fine.
Great.
Hi, I'm Peter.
Oh, good. So you can get all the time work custody of the So today's the first class of the extended?
She gave one lecture like a week ago, and then it was just just for the month of October. Or maybe is it twice a week? I forget the schedule.
It's every Friday.
Every Friday, because it's once a week, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a tough time, so.
You're making using surveys?
I'm going to see Dr. Oye again this week.
As soon as you're reaching, smoking cessation.
I don't know how formal it is about coming out at a specific time. I think it's just kind of.
He gave me his survey and said, I'm going to bring an item
from
I don't know if you even want to cut this down, but I'm not really an expert. I'm not an expert on cerebral design. I'll see if I need to get pressure from people I can refer to.
That's fine.
Good?
I don't know.
It's really good. So
you're going to be email. Yeah,
no, I really think that's helpful.
I'm not a free spirit in a way.
Yeah, a lot of decision tree. make your own decisions for whether it's cost benefit, cost effective.
How many classes do you have already this month?
Five classes. How many what?
How many classes did you have? Do you have two already?
How many classes?
Yeah, one of them was like an introduction and then a little bit of like slope. What is the slope? You know, what is the slope of the line?
The Y intercept.
The Y intercept. And then we have five
times. How is that?
Use these tools to assess individuals with diverse medical disorders and identify determinants of patient outcomes of healthcare. He's also studied adherence to medical regimens and other issues with the nexus of health, behavior, and the healthcare system. He is one of the principal investigators for CAPS, a project that has developed measures to assess consumer evaluations of hospitals, nursing homes, group practices, and individual physicians, as well as tools to report these assessments to healthcare providers and consumers. Dr. Hayes has published over 350 research articles and 31 book chapters, and is former editor-in-chief of Quality of Life Research and former deputy editor of Medical Care. He'll be speaking on the impact of using a next button in a web-based health survey on time to complete and with reliability of measurement. Dr. Hayes has indicated no conflict of interest for this program. Great, thanks.
Thanks everybody for coming. This is a real specific topic, so I hope it's not too boring, but I think it's somewhat important, even if it is very narrow. But I'm going to try to give you a little context for why we're interested in this issue. And some of that context may probably be more interesting than the actual focus of today. So, start off by saying that there are various co-authors, but this presentation is actually based on a brief paper that we just finished last week and submitted to Behavior Research Method. I'm also going to be presenting the same thing, so Dr. Maxman, in a month from now, at the International Society of Quality of Life Research meeting in New Orleans. I don't know if anyone's going to that, but it's actually got a lot of good and relevant work going on, including stuff about the use of health-related quality of life in clinical practice, which seems to be one of the hottest topics right now. And it's related to today's presentation. I provide my link to my website because this presentation is already posted, thanks to Karen Spitzer. She posted it earlier today, so all my presentations are posted there. And I actually posted it on Twitter as well today. Twitter, in a research useful way, not just for telling you, if I've got a headache or I'm tired, and that kind of thing. But evolve, it's useful. The background to this presentation is that it's related, the project is related to a PROMISE project, which is defined here in the first bullet, the Patient Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System. And this project started in late 2004. It's one of the NIH Roadmap Initiative projects funded by NIAMS, and actually NCI had a big role in its initiation, making sure that it actually happened. And was one of the co-participants in PROMISE 1. It actually just ended, PROMISE 1, but it was PROMISE 2 starting. And there were three main things that were the objectives of that project. First was develop item banks to assess health-related quality of life. So there's been this long history of health-related quality of life measurement. And now this project was trying to come together and make what's known as item banks. And those are sets of items that define specific domains of health-related quality of life and can be used in computer-adaptive testing. So the second aim was to develop actually the software to administer the items in a CAT, computer-adaptive test system. So with that ability to administer these using the computer, that means you can have long banks of items. You don't have to be as restricted in terms of the number of survey items because it can be unlimited in theory. Because what you're going to try to do when you actually use these things in the next phase of PROMISE, PROMISE 2, is actually to select the items that are most relevant to each user or each person that you're trying to assess. So based on how they respond to the initial item you give them, you can target which next item they will get, and you keep targeting items until you get a certain level of precision that is satisfactory to you, and you can stop the assessment. So you don't have to administer every single item. You only have to administer a small subset typically. And then the third thing was to make this all publicly available so that clinicians now and researchers can use the products in the future. And so far there's no charge for the software or for the item banks, and at some point there may be some charge that goes on. It's still not clear what's going to happen, but right now everything is publicly available and free. So what happened in this particular first phase of PROMISE, the end result was about 450 items were actually developed over this long process of survey development. So you come down to what's out there and available. You go to this site, forward at NIHpromise.org, which will lead you to this site. And NIHpromise.org also has other information. But if you go here, you'll see that these are the items that are available. So there are PDFs of paper and pencil versions of the items. There's also the software that will allow you to administer them using this computer adaptive testing technology. And there are short form versions of these things as well. But the focus in Promise One was on the main domains that have been around in health-related quality of life for a number of years. Mental health type domains, emotional distress. So there are 28 items that assess depressive symptoms, 29 that assess anxiety, 29 that assess anger. And then you can see there's a whole bunch of items that tap physical functioning. There are two subdomains within pain. There's a bunch of items that assess fatigue. And then satisfaction with social activities and participation in social roles. There are a smaller number of items. And then there are sleep and wake disturbances. And these are not really one part of the main Promise developmental work, but there was a supplemental project that was developed, and so they were also included in the set. But these probably are familiar to people who are used to health-related quality of life measures, the kind of things you're going to see in the SF-36 and other measures. And not necessarily exactly the same frame that you might see in every one of those instruments, but you can see that they're probably pretty familiar with the main. In some cases, like physical functioning, there was an intent to actually get subdomains, but when it came to the analysis, it turned out, for the most part, it looked like there was really one underlying factor or dimension. So the way these are listed really show how we get scores out of these different banks. Each of these that has, in parentheses, a number of items represents a single score that comes out. And each of those can be administered in a cap format. So you don't have to administer every one of these items. You only have to administer enough until you get adequate precision for the individual. So that's 10 different banks. We also have a set of 10 global items that I haven't listed here because those are really not cat items, but they're just a set of global items, like in general, how would you rate your health, to kind of give you an idea overall how someone's doing in their health. Okay, so with this set of item banks, then when you go to the point of actually saying, okay, I want to do a cat with them, what's important to keep in mind? When you're using these things, standard error is the big issue. You want to minimize the standard error and maximize precision or reliability. So in order to understand what's going on with the system, you have to kind of understand the standard error and reliability. And if you have Z scores, which means that when you score the items in a scale, you don't just put them on a 0 to 100 possible range or average together 1 to 5, response or something like that. You actually transform it so the mean is going to be 0 and the standard deviation is 1, either in the sample that you happen to be looking at if you're doing a research study or maybe some reference population like the U.S. general population. So when you get a Z-score then, that means when you're looking at numbers that can be positive and negative, the mean is 0, the standard deviation is 1. If that's the case, which has been typically the convention in item response theory type applications, which is what Promise is, we're really applying item response theory to the data we collect, then that means that you're going to have a reliability about 0.90 when the standard error is 0.32. So I'm just trying to get you familiar so you realize the relationship between reliability and standard error when you have a Z-score that you're working with. It'll go to 0.91 if the standard error is 0.30. And you could work out any configuration you want of the relationship between reliability and standard error. The only reason I show these two is because 0.90 has been a threshold that's been proposed and kind of adopted by people when you want to use measures for individuals. When we're talking about research studies, we say, well, we're going to shoot so that we get a reliability of 0.70 or higher for our measures. When we get to individuals, we have a much higher threshold, and it's 0.90 has kind of been proposed. You may even want to be more reliable than that. It's just the minimum is 0.90. So that's an important number to keep in mind. And that means the standard error is going to be 0.32 if you're in the Z-score metric. Now, the reason I add this 0.30 here is that typically people, even though they kind of say, well, this is the threshold I'm working with, they'll often sort of, they like round numbers, and they'll say, if I think of minimizing the standard error, I'm going to have it as a default in a cap set it at 0.30, and it's just a rounding type thing. It could be 0.32 if they want it to be anything, but often they'll set it 0.30 is what I'm going to try to get down to. So when I administer a cath to people, I'm going to keep administering items until it, the standard error falls below 0.30. Now, you can change that yourself, but that's often the default, and that is the default in the pharma's application of cath. So that's why I have that there, and that would be equivalent to reliability of 0.91. The reason the 0.90 threshold has been proposed is because if you actually look at the confidence interval around the score for an individual, even at 0.90 reliability, because the standard error is 0.3, that means that the standard error is about a third of the standard deviation. And if you work out the math, that means 1.96 times the standard error, you go in both directions and get the confidence interval, that if you had a score right at the average, your z-score was 0, then your confidence interval is negative 0.62 to 0.62. And then if you translate that to a t-score, even though z-score is the convention, actually in PROMIS and other applications of upgraded quality of life, people are actually kind of like a t-score better, even though it's just a linear transformation. One of the reasons they like it is you don't get negative scores. So that transformation, all you have to do is take every z-score, multiply it by 10, and add 50. This general formula works for any linear transformation, so this is going to make, whatever you put here is going to be the new standard deviation, whatever you put there is the new mean. So a t-score has a mean of 50 and a standard deviation of 10. If you do that here, that means the range is 44 to 56 for someone who scores right at the average, which is 50 in t-score metric. So that's like the SO36. If you think about the SO36, if you're used to that, the average is 50. If you got a score of 50 on an SO36 score, our confidence interval would extend from 44 to 56. So 0.6 standard deviations below to 0.6 above. So even with very good reliability, 0.90, for the individual, there's still a lot of lack of confidence around exactly where their score is. So when we use it clinically, you have to keep in mind that it's just a point estimate, but the real score could be +6. So that's important to keep in mind as we go forward, because when we actually use these in the CAD administration, what it is going to try to do is get that standard error to below 0.30. So this is taken from the assessment center site. I would have done it live, but things can go wrong in the live administration. So I went ahead and did this in advance and said, okay, I'm going to take the anger bank and try and answer in a semi-reasonable way about how I might respond if I was in a study. The first question that's going to come up by default, all these things will, you can change the defaults if you're actually using the system, but by default, it's going to pick an item that's somewhere in the middle of the underlying continuum. So anything you're measuring like anger, we're going to have items that are going to have more or less anger. Some are going to be harder for you to endorse. You have to be really angry to endorse, other than never. And some are going to be easier to endorse. This is going to be somewhere in the middle of the range of possibilities. So if I get this question here, in the past 7 days, I was grouchy. I'm going to say sometimes is going to be my response. I'm going to say never. It should be, that's nice if you're never grouchy. I'm not going to say always because that would be terrible if you like it. I'm going to say, sometimes I was grouchy in the past 7 days. And then down here, in the assessment center, by default, when I pick that, I then have to click next. So I'm going to hit the radio button. I'm going to fill that in. You're going to see a little black dot if I did it. It's going to be there as my answer. I can change it all I want. And then I push next, and it's going to go to the next item. So with the sometimes answer that I gave, it's then going to tell me, if I ask it to show me what's going on underneath this. And the first thing it's going to do is say, okay, that, your response was 3, if you count it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So 3 was sometimes what I gave for the previous answer. My estimated score, which is theta, the z-score metric is 0.61. The anger bank is scored so that a higher score is more anger. So if it says 0.61, it's already estimating my score based on one item. It's saying I'm 0.6 of the standard deviation above the mean. It's guessed based on my first answer. In the t-score metric, that's 56.1, which might be more familiar. 6 points above 50 where the standard deviation is 10. And then it's got my standard error. And this is in the z-score measure. So the standard error is 0.57. So I already showed the standard error, like it's 0.30 or below, or actually below 0.30 as a default. So it's, of course, with one item, my standard error is going to be estimated pretty high, higher than I'd like. Then I looked at the ask this question, and this question was picked based on my previous response. It's trying to get a question that fits me. It's not trying to get one that's too extreme that it can predict my answer from. It wants one that's not sure how I'm going to respond to it. So it says, I felt like I was ready to explode. Now that's because my first answer, they estimated my theta to be fairly angry, like 0.6, the standard deviation above the average anger score. Then it's going to give me one that's more extreme. It represents more extreme anger. So I felt like I was ready to explode. If you're ready to endorse that, you're probably pretty angry. And my answer to that was never. Didn't feel like I was ready to explode the last 7 days.
So how do you guess that error off one item?
Well, it's basically an estimate. Just you don't. Well, if you have one item, you can estimate test reliability. Anyway, not thinking of IRT at all. You can estimate what the precision is for any single item, even a possible test area.
Right, but for this respondent?
Yeah. It's based, it would be based on your response. If anybody gives that same response, they're going to have the same standard error. It's based on the pattern of responses. So it's that respondent, because they happen to give that one answer. Based on all the data that we have about what that response tells us about the true theta. So if you completed all 29 items, how close would I be to your actual score based on just that single response is what it's basically.
I see. So basically, when you look at a whole bunch of people who respond, give right. this response, that would have been the standard error for that group.
Right.
So you're assigning it to this individual.
Yeah, at this point, that's what we're doing. So you have to have prior data. That's why there's promise one. You have to have a good sample of people who've done it before, and based on their response, then you're saying, okay, here's the estimate standard error. Now, one thing, that it becomes more individualized as you go, though, because if you're inconsistent with your responses, your standard error is going to be very high. So unless you're consistent and you give reasonable answers, your standard error is not going to go down. That's one check on how it really becomes individualized. The other thing is you can test person fit, because this model that it's using is based on a sample of people and how they responded, and generally they responded in a consistent way, and the items were correlated positively and unidimensional. But you can see there's some people that, and it's usually due to inconsistency, so you can actually estimate whether they fit the model using a disease statistic called person fit statistic. And if they get a score that's high, that suggests that, you can try to apply this to them, but it's really not working. And sort of reinforces the idea that they'll probably not converge. They'll probably have to develop a full battery and still have a standard error that's not acceptable.
So this is just based on your responses. It isn't based on your characteristics.
Right. Although in theory, you could try to build in something about characteristic that would help with the first item. That's all that really helps us. So that, if I know that you're coming from a prison population, you're more likely to be angry. So I would start with an item that's more like the one you just saw, more extreme item, rather than in the middle. Okay, so then the third, this tells me here, okay, now it thinks my anger is closer to the mean because, I said never to that one extreme item. And it gives me, here's the Z-score estimate, here's the T-score estimate, you like that better, and the standard error goes down. But there was a big shift in my score based on, so the first item was really not giving me a very good estimate. The second one, it really shifted my score. The standard error went down a fair amount. And then on this one, I felt angry the past 7 days. I'm going to say rarely is my response. I'm not going to say never, but I'm going to say rarely. So it's not a huge amount of anger. And then that brings my score down. I'm getting closer to the average of 50 or close to zero if it's a Z-score. My standard error is going down. And then I'm getting another item. Felt angrier than I thought I should. I think never. That would be pretty extreme response. Other than never, I rarely thought it would be so bad. Of course, what would happen if I say always, that's going to increase my score the most. If I say often, it's going to increase it somewhat less and so on. And if I say rarely, it'll probably bring it up some, but if I say never, it may not, depending on how this got calibrated, but it may bring it up a little. And if I say never, it shouldn't bring it up, or it should lower. And so when I give that response, it actually lowers it. And now it even says I'm maybe a little below the mean. It's about 49 instead of 50. You can see the standard error is 0.36. We're still not at 0.30. So by default, again, I said it's going to fall below 0.30 before we stop. The other thing is that you're going to have to get at least 5 items. That's sort of a check. So that even if the standard error fell real quick, there's still always a little potential problem with three items. There's a few number of items that some people would say, well, we still want to give them five items just to be sure, because it might be that you got an inaccurate estimate of the standard error just based on three items that you happen to pick. It looked like they're real consistent and so forth. And you want to be sure, so you keep the ministering at least a minimum of whether it's five or five fault items. And then I felt annoyed. So this is the fifth item, and I just want to make sure I'm consistent. Sometimes is what I'm going to say to this one, and that's going to be some kind of anger, so it should bring my score up. It's indicating some level of anger. If it does bring my score up to right about 50 a little bit, and then the standard error goes to 0.32. And this is finally the last item, which is made myself angry about something just by thinking about it. And I'm going to say rarely, that's my answer. See, that's what the answer actually was. And then when I go on, it's finally done at that point. It only took six items to converge, and five is the minimum by default in the system, and I got down to 0.28. So with this, I know, exactly the standard error for me as an individual, and that's something you don't get in classical test theory either. And when you do this, it is going to be specific to the pattern of responses I gave. It's not going to be some overall level of reliability for the scale. And, I turn out to be right at the average, and I could have a confidence interval around that, which is probably going to be like 45 to 55, given what I said earlier about how much the confidence interval still is going to be fairly wide, even with a pretty good level of reliability.
So did your automatically stop because the PSD got below?
Yeah, and that's the way it's set up. But you can change, again, you can change the defaults, but it said at least five items is default, and when it falls below 0.3, I'll stop. You can keep it so it diminishes the whole thing if you want, or you can make it a different threshold, whatever you feel comfortable with. This is just for reasoning. Okay, so that's all background, because that's really not the topic, but it's kind of like, why did we even care about this issue at all? It's because this is where we were going with this, and that's what Promise is going to try to do in the future. And what I have here is there was a handout, which is a note that MSNBC covered Promise recently. I don't know if everybody has one of these. I'm around. You can back up. So it's single page, double sided. Yeah. If you don't have one, there's a couple more up here. But this is something you can read later, just so you know that it actually reached the press, and there's a yellow David Seller, because he's the head of the Statistical Coordinating Center. Some people here know him. Is quoted. And then on the backside, there's actually someone from UCLA, Dr. Hidalgo, in pain medicine. At least they're affiliated with UCLA, is talking about the use of this thing, but they're just talking about the pain bank, which is just one of the banks, but it's becoming kind of a popular topic. How are these things actually going to be used in clinical practice? Okay. So when we were trying to deal with this issue, this was prior to the Promise work that's now completed. It was in the early days of Promise. We're trying to say, okay, if we're actually going to administer these items by computer, now this is the way the screen will look with these radius buttons here. Should we have this next button, and should we have a back button? That's really the decision that we're trying to make. Because, if you click on your response, you can automatically go to the next screen just after you click, or you could then require that they hit the next button. And, of course, if you require them doing the next button, that's going to take them longer. It's going to somewhat annoying. You have to do two clicks. But then if you take them to the next screen, you want them to be able to go back or not. And, going back has a lot of advantages because maybe they accidentally picked a response and, they want to change it. But the disadvantage might be, okay, if you're doing a cap, that means you have them come back and maybe they are then presented with a different item because it's just their answer to the item that precedes it. So that was the issue that we were trying to deal with. So we did a study before. The main Promise was that we developed the item banks. It was a small study, and it's got its limitations, as you'll soon see, in terms of who we included and so forth. But the idea was really to look at this next button and the back button in the various combinations of either getting the next button or not and having the back button or not. And look at whether it affected how long it took people to get through items, how many missing responses they had, how precise they were, and what score they ended up with. And so we had randomized experimental four conditions, the two things we're interested in, next and back button. So in the automatic advance condition, you didn't have a next button. Just as soon as you gave your response, you went up to the next item. And there was one case where you're not allowed to go back either. So we call that the auto go back condition. then we varied that, so we said you go automatically advance to the next item, but you're allowed to go back if you want to change your answer or look at your answer. And then we varied the other thing where instead of automatically advancing, you had the next button you had to get, but you weren't allowed to go back to get the next button, and you were allowed to go back. So that's what we were testing.
So just in general, how often do people change their choices?
I don't actually have good data on that, but it's not very much. It's what we saw. I don't actually have an estimate of that. But it didn't. You'll see in the timing for one thing, it doesn't make that much difference. People aren't going back. It's really a safeguard mechanism. That's what it turns out to be.
Right, but having to go back is a real pain.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, that's part of why people don't go.
No, but in general, how much, like...
What do you mean? You're just researching? Are you talking about the study or just in general?
Well, or the promise thing, right? So if you have your choice, and, which means there has to be some sort of next button, how often do people change? Because changing with or without a back button is probably a big difference.
You mean so they're on the screen and they enter an answer, and before they go to next, they change? Yeah, we don't have that data. That's a good question. They are only competing to capture it. It's like an initial pledge. I think it only gets captured once or the next button. That would be a great study to do. Yeah, I would imagine there's a lot more of that before you do the next button. But then I guess you can infer from the automatic advance. There aren't a lot of people. I know you said it's trouble to go back, but if you have the automatic advance condition and you had the wrong response, I think if you knew that right off the bat, you'd be likely to go back in that case. I mean, we don't know for sure because it's still a thing to go back. But there weren't a lot of people going back in the automatic advance condition. That's the only thing I can infer.
Yeah, but see, I'm worried about because if you go back, it means that you've now been informed by the next screen.
Yeah.
And
right. That
may very well affect.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
so those are not the same thing.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that, yeah, that's true. Yeah, they're not comparable at all. Okay, so when we did the test, we went to Polymetrics. So you can go to their website and see they do all kinds of political studies. But one of the decisions that was made in Promise was actually the RFA, when it was written, implied that it would be the traditional collection of data at clinical sites that you normally do. It's really onerous and so forth. But then someone in one of the initial meetings said, you know, there's these polling companies. We can get our data in no time from them. Why don't we just go ahead and use them? And so we ended up doing it for this study. And we actually promised, the main Promise data, the bulk of it is from Polymetrics. So one of the questions that is going to be, so far it hasn't been as big a deal as we thought, but how good is this data? We know these type of people that are in these polling studies are much different than people in general. So Promise 2 will actually try to collect more data from real people. But these data that were collected from this particular pilot study and Promise in general were from people who signed up with this company, do surveys on a regular basis. So they're very unusual. You can see that in their characteristics right off the bat. I mean, look at the study sample. The age is not necessarily atypical. We had about 807 people, so about 200 in each of the four groups. And, here's their characteristics. Well, for one thing, they're primarily white, not that diverse in terms of race ethnicity. But the big thing is education. You get a huge number of people with college education, 44%. Some college, 37% college plus. And so Hung Hu actually worked on this project too, and when we collected the data, it was fairly similar in the main study. He actually had to do a whole bunch of analyses to kind of weight the data and create a subset that's more like the U.S. general population on census numbers. And it looks pretty good when you weight it and get comparable data from other U.S. general population samples, but still, you don't know on a lot of unknown variables if it's really going to hold up.
So was this purportedly trying to be a representative sample of the population?
No, not trying, not in this case at all. It was just who was available in their particular...
But I mean, was it being sampled in...
You mean their sample... In general, they try to say it's like... It's a lot of these marketing firms do this. They have a lot of people, and they can cut it up in different ways for you. You can, restrict it in some way, but the sample itself is just whoever happens to volunteer to do it. It's really not...
So these are phone surveys?
No. This was done on the web. They do most of the surveys on the web. So that's what we're trying to do here, to get people on the web. But still, this is a sample we're working with. So you just have to know that they're very educated and they're very white. So whether this generalizes or not, it's not going to be at all clear.
So this is a sample that informed Promise 1?
Yeah, this is our sample right here that I'm talking about in the study that we're testing the four conditions on. This sample. This is 807 people. But I also was saying that in Promise, when the main data was collected, we used Polymetric as well. It wasn't 807, it was a lot more. But we went to the same polling firm and collected a lot of data from that. We also had some clinical sites, but 90% of the data came from the polling company.
But it's very telling that it's less than 2%. 2% have less than
right. That's good. I mean, the education, very educated population. So whether you can generalize or not. Now, so like I said, we had like 23,000 observations in Maine Promise when we're getting the banks. And so what Hamdu did in terms of that was to get a subset that was less educated and try to match as best he could to census data and U.S. general, and then weight the data so that you say, okay, well, what's our health compared to other national samples for health that's been collected? And he did pretty well of representing our sample with weights to look like other general population samples, but still there's a lot of unknowns that are really going to hold up on unknown, unmeasured variables and so forth.
Well, just asking in general, I'm sorry, it's a little off.
Okay.
But if you're trying to if you're wanting to look at the population, and you have something that's so unlike the population, obviously you want to do some weighting to try to correct the distortions in the data, which may allow your data overall to look more like the population. But it'd be hard to say that the data from something like this look like the less than high school graduate population.
Yeah, you can do almost nothing to make that happen. If you have 2%. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. It's so extreme. No matter what you do, you can kind of compensate, but you really can't. So that's what I'm saying too. In this particular study, our four conditions, we randomized people to the conditions, and as you might know, we didn't have differences in age, gender, race, ethnicity, and education. And that's what's shown here. I mean, you might eyeball it, think there are differences, but there are no statistically significant differences in our four groups in terms of the characteristics of people on these variables that we measure. So, this is a weird sample. To begin with, the randomization was successful within the four groups. Then another thing we had to do before we analyzed the data here is to purify the sample, because you get people, when they're doing these web-based surveys, some people are really not, well, we don't think they're paying attention or reading the items very carefully. They're just trying to get through as quickly as possible, because they get rewards for being in the panel, completing surveys, and some people are just interested in the rewards. You know, they're not the greatest rewards in the world, like a $5 coupon or something, but they go through really fast, and we don't think they're paying attention. So the first thing was, we said, if their average response was less than 2 seconds of items that we administered, we're just not even going to include the data. So we deleted 18 people right off the bat in the auto no back condition. So that's the condition where people are going to probably be the fastest, because as soon as they get a response, they go on to the next item, and they're not allowed to go back. And it turns out, yes, we have more people, we have 18 of them, who, on average, took less than 2 seconds to answer items. So there's nothing keeping them, slowing them down, and they're going the fastest. But to make it comparable, we also deleted the fastest 18 respondents in the other three conditions. And if you look at those 18 respondents in the other three conditions, there were 10 of them in the auto-back group, where they automatically went to the next item, but they could go back if they wanted to. So it's a little slower, potentially, than the first group. And indeed, you get quite a few. 10 people are less than 2 seconds to answer, but the other 8 were longer than 2 seconds, but they were still deleted because they were the 18,000. And then in the other groups, where you have the next button, you only got a few people who were going faster than 2 seconds per item. But we still deleted the 18 fastest in each of the groups, just again to be comparable. So we did that up front, and what were these people administered? They were administered just some items. There were social role activity items that we had at the time. There were 56 of those questions, these kind of things like limited in doing work, regular family activities, leisure activities, and then 56 other items on social role activities, satisfaction with them, being happy or satisfied with being able to do various social activities and work. So it was only in the social role domain that we tested this, because we were doing other things at the time, and this was just an opportunity. We could not test it on all the artists, but so it's limited to these particular artists, if the question we're interested in. And then again, once we've collected the data, we're going to look at time to respond, number of missing items, control consistency, reliability, and the average score that we got in those two domains that we looked at, the social role domains. So what did we find? Well, the main thing we found was time was different. How long people took, which is not too surprising, but when you just advance them automatically and they had no back button, they got through 13 items per minute. It's really fast. Again, this is indicative of our sample, very highly educated people who've been doing these surveys online before. Before this study, our rule of thumb, the number of items that people could answer was 3 to 5 items per minute. And that's held up on paper and pencil surveys pretty well for a long time. So our estimate going in would have been 3 to 5 items. They're getting through 13 items per minute in this fastest condition. And when you add the back button, it doesn't slow down that much. So that's why I'm saying, at least in the back button, there weren't that many people going back. So they're almost the same. It's hardly out of effect. 1 item per minute less. It's still really fast. Then when you have the next step, it really slows it down a fair amount, but they're still answering a lot of questions. So if there's no back button, it's 9 items per minute. If there's a back button, again, 8 items per minute. So you can see there's 4 items per minute less if you have the next button. So that's a huge impact on speed. But again, all of these are very fast. So even here, where it's 9 items per minute or 8 items per minute, that's still a lot faster than 3 to 5 items per minute. And so I know this is a really unusual sample because they're so educated and they're so white and so forth. So it's a real extreme estimate. But I do have one other data point where Dinesh Kana in rheumatology actually has administered the Promise cats to, I don't know how many people now, but at the time when we had the estimates, it was about 100 people and with scleroderma. And they had, some people had real limitations of using the mouse and answering the items, so they were kind of an extreme, other type extreme sample of people. And he got 6 items per minute on average for this sample of 100 people across a lot of the Promise cats banks. So probably more realistic in clinical practice is going to be like 6 items per minute versus 9. So this is up by quite a bit. But still, even then in his sample, 6 items per minute is still in the high end of what we would have expected going in. So it does seem like people are able to answer items faster on a computer than they are on paper and pencil. Although we have a lot more data we have to collect now. Definitively about it. So then in terms of missing data and reliability, those did not differ by group. This is the missing data rates for the two domains that we assessed, social role performance and social role satisfaction. You can see that the rates of missing data are about 1% for each of the groups, which didn't seem to matter very much which group, but it wasn't significantly different. And then if you estimate internal consistency reliability, these are 56 item scales, not surprisingly, that's very high, 0.99 in every case. Because you've got so many items that you're going to get high reliability no matter what. There wasn't really any difference between groups in that regard either. And when you looked at mean scores in each of these domains, they didn't differ by group. So the only place we saw a difference was in time to complete.
So the missing items is they can hit the next button without answering? Is that whether they're missing items?
Yeah. So
you're not forcing an answer.
You're not forcing them to respond. Even for human subject treatment, you're not supposed to do that anymore. So it could skip. If they hit the next button, if they're in the next condition, if they're in the next item, or if they're in the other condition, they can just skip over it without expecting the energy.
How do you skip if there's no next button?
You just hit the energy. I mean, it's not ideal, but you can see it didn't matter anyway. But that's a whole issue of how you do it, and actually it'll come up here in a second how you should really do it, but it actually wasn't done that way in the pilot. So what we recommended is you think about using the automatic advance rather than the next button, because the next button can be really annoying to people. It didn't seem to make any difference in terms of speed. You seem to not have that many mistakes going on where people accidentally hit the wrong choice. And it could be really important, like Dr. Pena, when he implemented it, you know, he actually implemented it with the next button, and people were complaining about it. He said, you know, I clicked already, but I've actually clicked twice. So in those kind of situations, it seems like it's probably a good idea to consider that. But to have the back button, so if they do accidentally hit the wrong choice, at least they have the option to go back. And then, you know, like Neil said, well, maybe that won't be perfect. So in that case, it's different because it's a new item, but at least they do have the opportunity to go back if they want to. But, you know, it's even critical.
I'm troubled by your outcome variable, right? I mean, isn't the outcome variable the individual's reliability, which you don't seem to have, right? I mean, I'd rather have data that are right rather than data that are fast.
Yeah, well, yeah, we estimated the reliability at the group level in this case, and the reason we did it is because we didn't have it calibrated at that point. This was pre-promised, so we could actually... Although it would be difficult now, but we actually might be able to go back and estimate the precision for the individuals. Now, one thing to keep in mind, though, when you look at the reliability for individuals, basically you should average out pretty much to the reliability that you get at the group level. So it probably won't change the overall conclusion. I mean, at any individual, you might get a very poor reliability, but if you have reliability at the group level that's high, that means the average across the people, you should see higher reliability. But it's still a good idea to do it. It's just it may be really difficult because it turns out we had more trouble with this domain. We only have like 12 or 14 items in the end. And whether those items are really worded exactly the same as they were in this pilot paper or not, I'm not sure. And we can try to go back and use the calibrated, you know, mapping parameters that we got in promise eventually and apply them back, you know, retroactively. I just don't know logistically whether we can do it, but it's a great idea just to look. It could be, you know, but even on the average, it's not good. But let's say we had enough low education people, it's in them where it really matters. There could be an interaction or something. So we, you know, we say, well, maybe I'll write it, it's okay at the group level, but you really are going to screw up these people who need to hit the next button in order to be careful of, you know, their reliability goes down. We don't have that condition.
Well, I mean, I think, you did show clearly what the difference in the time was, and, you know, you talked about the group reliability. I would agree the individual about reliability is of interest, in particular because you wonder about how effectively people are reading something if they spend just 4 seconds looking at the screen.
Right.
And one of Woody Allen's movies, the character says, I took the Evelyn Wood speed reading course and read War and Peace in 20 minutes. It's about Russia. and you would worry, you know, especially since you're trying to collect data, that people, or some categories of people, perhaps all people, aren't reading questions very well. But in some way, maybe it's retest reliability that you want to be able to measure, although if they're selectively picking the first choice every time, that's not going to tell you much. But in some way, trying to figure out what is the minimum amount of screen time that you produce for a lot of
people. Yeah, actually, that's good. You know, following up on what Neil said, though, would be really interesting to see. Because we did interpret in one direction, the faster is better, but there's probably some threshold, just like being screened initially, that you could actually do that. Now, with the data we've got now, let's say how much time is associated with reliable measurement. When does it sort of, the reliability go down because they're so fast? Or does it? And it doesn't vary by people. But I couldn't do that with this data, like I said, because we didn't have it, then it would be a great thing for the future. If we've got data, then we'll have something like that.
I'm thinking, so without the next button, and if one didn't know that, you know, you have to return to go to the next screen, and if one didn't want to answer that, or you know how to, or wanted to skip it, and didn't know how to, they might just fill in any.
Right. But it didn't turn out to make any difference in terms of missing data, but you could have individuals that felt forced to do it because they didn't understand.
Right, and then you would not have access.
Yeah. But it didn't turn out on the average to matter, but yeah, for any individual, they may have to give any answer to get to the next screen.
And that could also contribute to how quickly, you know, the personal question is
right.
You know, the speed of.
Yeah, it could speed them up because how they want to do it the next time, you know, thinking about it. Again, on average, it didn't seem to matter like that right now.
A couple of questions. One I was wondering was, were you able to look at the actual question, whether it was a one-line, two-line, or three-line question, whether that actually impacted time?
No, but that's another good thing. But one thing about Promise is the questions are really pretty short, and there's a lot of effort to make them simple. There aren't real long questions, but you could do... Well, there is, like, there's actual lifestyle estimates on them. And this is something we've actually done in Rickmar. And the classical test theory thing, Marie Fungwa just finished a paper where she looked at readability of items and missing data and found a correlation between items that were harder in terms of number of syllables and so forth. But there's lifestyles, and that's sort of like, if it's a lot of short words, it's long and convoluted. You can't get everything like that, but we shouldn't get an estimate at the really flesh and data to even level. Well, we've got lifestyle estimates and promise, which are better for the rest of our people-based estimates and how complicated the sentence is. You can correlate that with how long it takes and the original missing data. So that was another feature research project.
And then the other question was, the next time is important, but I think it's a huge pain behind to go from the radio down to the next button. Is there any possible way that if you actually click the radio button and then wait for it to confirm that, take a second, and then the next button would be right there where the radio button is, so that it confirms that you want to pick that and you don't have to drag
it down? Something like that sounds like a good idea. I mean, you better technology with me. That would make you
know. There's something.
I'm sure it's very can. I don't know if anyone's actually doing it, but something like that problem, right?
You know, maybe it's the traversal sound. It might also be, of course, kind of rethought for people to know this stuff. And because the comment I was going to make in the question was, for most surveys, we really do want people to not make a mistake. But since this is CAT, I wonder if the consequences of a mistake are sort of auto-corrected in a way. Because if you happen to just, miss, or you're kind of going too fast in the first time, you'd be like, oh, wow. I got the wrong thing. The next one is going to take you back to where you need anyway.
Yeah, it'll just take longer to converge.
Exactly.
But yeah, you do have a natural, especially if you have enough items, which you do.
Yeah.
If you have 29 items, you make one mistake, you're probably going to converge instead of six items, it's going to take eight or something.
Exactly. So
yeah.
The consequences are, auto-corrected.
Yeah.
Maybe you actually know consequences.
It's just the condition where they're just kind of going through really fast and everything.
People who are going through and not thinking about it, I was a little worried that 2 seconds is kind of an arbitrary cutoff. When I've looked at time spent on questions, I haven't found like a nice bimodal. Ideally, we find some kind of bimodal distribution. But some people do seem to go through the knowledge test of it very quickly and accurately.
Yeah.
And
it's hard because it's not just one
of the mass readers of what can't read it. And then some people are clearly just crashing through it and not thinking about it that much.
Yeah. Kim, can I get back in one second? I just want to make sure that I say these ones in this thing because we're running out of time to hear the question there. So this is the sort of the caveat for that, because some of it was coming up. The thing about the next button is it does make it easier to skip items, like people are saying. If you were to do it the right way, you have to do something, and when you don't have an next button, you have to have a choice to just prefer not to answer. You really need the IRB requirements, you really need to care to people, you can't kind of hide that, it's just kind of just what happens in the pilots. And the other thing is the automatic advance is not going to work if you have select all of the apply, because you don't know how many answers people are going to select. So those kind of questions, you have to switch and you won't have automatic advance, but just when you have one response choice and then flip and make people think, well, now in this case, it's not automatically advanced, and I have to do the next button just for these items, it gets more complicated. And then there's this thing about CAD. It's not that horrible, but when you allow people to go back, it is a little trickier because they may see an item, they'll go back to change it, and then they're going to see a different item, and they might be confused and say, well, why did you switch the item on? You just don't understand what's going on. Plus, at the end of the CAD, if this idea of going back, you get to the final item, typically then it's going to stop. If it gets to a standard error below 0.30, it's just going to stop and not give you another item. That doesn't give you a chance to go back. You have to have a screen at the end that sort of says, well, we think we're done, but we're going to let them go back if they want to, and if they don't go back, then we're going to stop. But typically, it's just going to end the assessment like it did with the game. It's not going to let you change that final item.
About the prefer not to answer option. My reservation with that is that you're constantly reminding
me. Yeah, that's the downside, right?
Yeah, so
I
talked about this with somebody at the Primer IRB conference. He said what he's done in the past is he's not put in that I want to skip option at all. He's put in a next button, and then if they hit next without selecting, a screen comes up that says, are you sure you want to skip that question? And gives them the option to go back.
Yeah.
So you're both, you know, respecting the human subjects issue and trying to do something about preventing missing data.
Yeah.
That's, and I think that sounds like a good pathway to go. So I don't know how.
Do you have a response?
I was going to say, what about just putting the skip button down and the next button has, you know, so they have to move their mouse down there and just skip. Yeah.
Skip, but it's like saying, do you want to skip?
Right.
You don't want to keep reminding you can skip.
Right. Well, but then maybe a public alert is that they're sure you want to skip.
Yeah, but
or make it a pain for them.
Or good people don't skip.
And we only do research with good people.
What
about just having a prefer not to answer this? As opposed to having a separate button for the person to answer.
That's a problem.
Oh,
you're constantly reminding them, you don't have to answer. You don't have to answer. And you don't want to keep sending that message.
So that was this one, though, right?
You do that in the consent process. You know, if there's no answer, you know, you don't want to answer a particular item, you don't have to. But you don't want to keep reminding every item.
Well, I mean, there's pros and cons to anything.
Yeah.
That's, you know, you're giving them the most choice, but then you're encouraging them to want
to
do that. So you're opening the Pandora's box. Yeah, but since in any event you're trying to manipulate them to do more or less in a particular period of time to optimize patterns of response, one could argue that one should at least evaluate technologies where you prevent people from answering questions appropriately. So if someone gets a screen, maybe they can be told at the beginning that you need to read all the responses before, and then within a second of getting to the screen, they're clicking an answer. They won't let them answer.
Yeah.
So you need to read the question.
Sure. You just throw out a computer license thing like that.
Yeah.
You don't have that screen open or don't scroll down.
Yeah.
It won't let you do it.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I just want to say before, just a minute, you know, Promise 2, now there were 6 sites and one, now there are 12, and actually we have just been notified that this will be funded. So this is happening right now, just getting going.
Yeah,
I'm working on this with them.
Is he in here?
He's in rheumatology. And I don't know if Tanya's working on that or not. We were hoping Tanya would be working on it. She's back there. And she's actually the survey person now. But there's something funny that happened in the application space. We kind of found out. Anyway. Any other questions? No. Okay. Thank you.
Amazing what dice you these little questions on.
Right.
Turned out to be